Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Making the Scene. I'm your host, Eric Sipple. On this podcast, we bring on a guest. That guest chooses a scene from a movie that means a lot to them, sometimes their favorite, sometimes not. And we go into detail on why and how that scene works, from technical angles like editing and lighting, to performance, to whatever random things might pop into our head. The idea being to get into the meat of why a scene really, really works. Today, I am joined by Joseph Lewis, and how you doing today, Joe?
I'm doing great, Eric. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm excited to have you on the podcast. We actually
Thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, no problem. It's exciting. Yeah. We actually met for the first time in person in Alabama a couple of weeks ago.
Right, at Phoenix Fest. It was awesome.
And in fact, I pitched the idea of this podcast to a table full of much better podcasters. And and I as soon as I said the idea, both Joe and Ken immediately had their scenes ready. I've had other people struggling to pick out a scene, but you knew immediately. As soon as this idea came up, you knew what you wanted to talk about.
Immediately, I knew it had to be the drug deal from the end of Boogie Nights. Because literally, this has been pretty much my favorite scene in any movie since I first saw it when I was 15.
That is awesome. I'm a big fan of this too. So we're going to be talking about Boogie Nights today, written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. This is the first Paul Thomas Anderson movie I saw, and I actually didn't like it the first time I saw it. When I first saw it, I don't know what it was, but I think I was taking it a little too seriously. And when I realized to go back that I was supposed to be laughing for good chunks of it, when I realized that a lot of it was actually a kind of a dark comedy,
right?
Then I loved it. So that was my trial by fire. The first time I saw it, I thought that was well made, but it just didn't. I don't know. Something was weird. And someone said, go back and watch it kind of as a comedy.
The tone didn't sit right with you, sort of?
Yeah, I think I was just an idiot. I mean, it was my first year in college when this came out. So that makes me at my peak stupidity, basically. I thought it was more serious. I was expecting it to be more serious than it had any intention of being, even though it's very serious at times.
Well, that's the thing with Paul Thomas Anderson's writing. The tone always catches you off guard. Even in something as heavy and dramatic as Magnolia, there are scenes of ribald humor in that movie that are just hysterical.
Oh, absolutely. He's a really offbeat and funny writer sometimes. And this is the moment when I should note that that I'm a big fan of Paul Thomas Anderson, but when forced to name my favorite movie, it is not this Paul Thomas Anderson movie, but it's Magnolia. So that now, is
that favorite movie of all time or favorite Paul Thomas Anderson movie?
That's my stock favorite movie of all time answer. I don't actually have a favorite movie, but I can get into a conversation about my ideals in cinema and storytelling by answering Magnolia. Right. So I settled on that because I feel like it most exemplifies the kind of filmmaking I like. And what the great thing is that Boogie Nights exemplifies a lot of that too.
Yeah.
Which I'm excited to get to talk about this movie because of that, because he is a very passionate filmmaker in terms of the film that gets made. It's a very passion filled, style of filmmaking.
In terms of the style and in terms of just how much you can tell that he loves his characters with every fiber of his being.
he is not a cold or distant filmmaker in any
way,
shape, or form.
He is not. These are his children.
Yeah. And it's great for a movie like this where we have a bunch of fuck-ups, basically, populating this movie, even more so than a lot of his other movies. This is quite a collection of oddballs. And we're catching, so the scene we're going to be doing is, as Joe said, the drug deal scene. So Joe, why don't you give us an idea of what scene we're going to be watching and why this scene? Why did you choose this one?
Okay. Like I said, I first saw this movie when I was 15, so that was a really formative time for me in terms of the movies that I was watching and realizing that I wanted to be a filmmaker myself. And I was already a fan of Quentin Tarantino at the time, who's still was and still is my favorite director. And one of the things I loved about Quentin Tarantino is how expertly he married soundtrack with visuals in every single one of his movies. And then I come around to Boogie Nights and I get to this scene at the end of this epic character study of sorts, and get to the drug deal, And it's like a symphony, man. Just the period music and the slow ratcheting up of tension and the just completely off the wall insane performances in it, that and the obviously the violent climax of it just completely spellbound me as a teenager. And looking at it now, like 7 years later, it's even more impressive to me, because just thinking about the way, the place in which it falls within the structure of the movie, it's so, like, such a contained sequence in comparison to all of these other sequences that are, like, expertly orchestrated to include a whole bunch of different characters. This one is really just focusing on a select few, but really just Dirk. This is a very important moment. This is Dirk's epiphany at the end of this movie.
Yeah, this is his rock bottom in terms of his descent into drug use. And
this is his rock bottom. Like it says in the title card right before it, it's a long way down.
I'm excited that you chose this scene, because it is almost a movie within a movie.
It truly is.
It introduces a character played by Alfred Molina that we haven't seen until, haven't even heard of until this title card pops up. It's a bizarre diversion into the hell that Dirk's life has become.
Right.
And it is a strange and off-putting hell that his life has become.
And Dirk, at this point in the movie, he's at a low place. He's had a falling out with Jack, the Burt Reynolds character. He's addicted to coke and probably some other drugs, I believe. His music career is not working out very well, possibly because he's singing the Transformers song, but it is what it is. And like he's turned to prostitution. He just got beat the fuck out of by a bunch of guys, and this is a last resort in many ways.
So before we get into the nitty gritty of this scene, Joe, tell the audience a little bit about yourself. Who are you, Joe Lewis? Who are you?
Who is Joseph Lewis? Well, I am from a little town in Virginia that you've never heard of. I love movies with every fiber of my being. I've wanted to be a filmmaker pretty much since I was 12 and saw Pulp Fiction for the first time. That's basically all I've ever wanted to do with my life. I've made several short films, including the kind of pilot for a television series, Nowheresville, which you can watch on YouTube at youtube.com/toastedschizo. That's SCHIZO. And I recently just graduated from a university with a degree in broadcast communication. So I know what I'm talking about, but I kind of think that's bullshit.
It sounds like you know more about what you're talking about than I do, and this is my show. So enjoy running circles around me as we discuss this scene.
Somehow I feel like it's going to be the other way around, but we'll see.
please, come on. You should all check out Joe's stuff. He's a fixture in my podcasting and film Twitter circles, and I'm really excited to get to finally talk to him, because I think we've been missing each other on all of the various podcasts that we skim through, Joe. I don't think we've actually gotten a chance to really talk, and other than at Phoenix Fest.
We haven't, sadly, and a big part of that is because until recently, my technology for podcasting was very limited. I finally just bought a proper mic that actually worked with my computer that will connect to the internet properly. For some reason, my laptop won't do shit in terms of Skype, so we're good now.
Excellent. Well, then let us proceed into the crazy drug deal scene of Boogie Nights.
Let's do it.
I think a good place to start is there's sort of an intro moment to this scene, which is the three characters who are Dirk Diggler, Todd, who's played by Thomas Jane, and John C. Reilly's character, whose name I'm actually blanking on now that I'm talking about it.
Reed Rothschild. I love that he has a comic book name.
It's fantastic. He has definitely is.
And Dirk Diggler does too, actually.
Yes.
I mean, obviously not his real name, but and those two meet, they bond over Star Wars immediately.
Thomas Jane is in this scene, and we'll talk more about his performance later, but I didn't know who Thomas Jane was when I saw this movie, and I actually didn't know this was Thomas Jane until much later, after I knew who he was,
mm-hmm.
and realized that I had seen him already a billion times in this madness of a scene.
Yeah.
But they pull up in Dirk's muscle car, and And there's this, this is a kind of funny intro of the three of them looking like bumbling fools, walking into the stupidest possible idea, basically.
It is. Yeah, like, Todd's walking up these stairs, and he's like feigning swagger. Like, he thinks he knows exactly what they're going to go in and do, even more so than we realize at this point, because we don't know exactly what he has up his sleeve yet. Whereas Dirk and Reed are a little more reserved about the whole situation.
And we get this great... So, you know, we come into this scene knowing that the intention is to rip this character off. They're going to go to this person's house, they're going to sell them baking soda for $5,000, right, and get out. And that's the idea. And even that just sounds like these three are dead.
This could easily go tits up at any moment.
It's going to be a colossal mess. And then we get this first indication of the tension rising, which is Todd stepping out and showing that he's got a fucking gun. Like... He's brought a gun to this meetup.
Right.
And that's the first moment that you realize that this is already escalating. We haven't even started yet, and it's already escalating.
Yeah. And that's even foreshadowed a bit. Like, at the very moment, the shot that follows them up the stairs, at the very moment that shot begins, before the car even pulls up, you see the house in the background, and the camera is perfectly leveled with it. But the road that the car is pulling up on, you can tell it's going to be a steep downhill as soon as you turn left. So it's immediately you get the sense of this downward descent.
I love that. I didn't notice that it's the house is totally level and the street is downhill. And it's great because I actually think this starts a really common theme in this movie, which is use of foreground and background things. That there's a lot of depth to what's happening in all of these scenes, and it starts right here.
Absolutely.
They pop up the stairs and I also love you get, I mean, John C. Reilly, Reed falls walking up the steps. And everything about this scene again just feels like, excuse me, like a mess is coming. And what I love is that as soon as they enter the house, there's this black cage door in front of the house. And Paul Thomas Anderson is an interesting director in that he'll do these really, really like moving, like shots are all over the place, the camera's panning, the camera's pushing in, and then every once in a while he'll just hang with a shot for a really long time.
To add emphasis or to increase tension.
And we get that here when they walk in and we just get this really long shot of this black door closing on them.
Yes, and Sister Christian starts playing, and it's like, that's not an ominous song, but it has never been more ominous than it is in this moment.
and this is like what's interesting, and we get this on the outro too. The use of music in this scene is really interesting because when we're outside, we don't have that. You know, we don't have songs, and then we get it as soon as we come in. As soon as we're in the house, the pop music.
Right.
Start.
And it's very, all three of the songs in this sequence are extremely upbeat and poppy, completely contrasting what is happening in the scene.
There's a lot of things that contribute to the tension of the scene, because as soon as we're in the house, you can just tell something bad is going to go wrong. You don't know what it is, and if you thought you know what it was, you're probably wrong the first time you watch it.
You're definitely wrong. There's no way you could predict firecrackers.
Yeah. As soon as you walk in, there's so much going on in the scene. There's already three characters in the house. There's Alfred Merlina's character, Rahan.
Rahad,
excuse me. Yeah. And his bodyguard, and then this character Cosmo. Who's just setting off firecrackers in the house as soon as you walk in. I mean, as soon as you cut to the inside, there's Alfred Merlina smoking crack out of a pipe, and this
facing away from the camera
in the silver robe.
Yeah,
and Cosmo setting off firecrackers,
just pacing around the room, and it's so bizarre. Thorough mindfuck for the audience.
This might be some of the best use of sound in a movie I've seen in terms of like increasing the tension purely through sound. If you had nothing else going on, just the relentless pounding of this pop music and the punctuation of those firecrackers is nerve-wracking. This is a 10-minute scene, and those firecrackers don't stop for most of it.
They don't, and it keeps the viewer just as on edge as these three dudes are as they go to sit down on this couch.
and it's great because the three guys are obviously, you know, they're coked up. Everyone in this scene almost is coked up.
Yeah.
And they're strung out.
Is anyone not coked up?
I'm going to guess the bodyguard might not be.
The bodyguard probably isn't.
He seems pretty chill, and I'm not sure. Cosmo might be on a psychedelic. I'm not sure that Cosmo is coked up, because he doesn't seem to care what's going on in the scene.
He doesn't.
Otherwise, but Rayhat is absolutely out of his mind, coked up, and the three of them are so strung out, and every time a firecracker goes off, they jump constantly, over and over again. And you watching, it's funny how when you watch a character jump in a scene, it gets in your head. Like, if that firecracker was something you would have tuned out normally, seeing a character jump a couple of times, suddenly you become attuned to that sound yourself, and you don't even need to see them jump anymore, because now you're freaking out by those sounds as well.
Right. Right, because you've started to put yourself in their place, and you're like nervously anticipating it just as much as they are.
Yeah, and John C. Reilly is sort of the master at selling the jump at the firecracker. He is freaking out.
I noticed that, like, sitting in the center of this couch, like, Todd is to his left, like trying to play it as cool as possible. When a firecracker goes off, he doesn't really jump that much. Like, you can see him flinch, but he tries to keep his cool. Dirk on the other side is so out of it at this point that he jumps, but it's the most half-hearted jump in the world. Whereas Reed in the middle, just like, oh, holy shit.
No one wants to be in this scene less than Reed Rothschild. He has no desire to be in this. And so one thing I noticed, and there's two bits of costuming that I want to mention. It was actually the first time I really talked about costuming much in this, but there's sort of, maybe three important costuming choices that are made in this scene that I like. And the first is that is Todd's outfit, which is pure 80s. And I realized in this, now that I've seen the other movie and come back to it, this Todd is dressed like the driver in Driver, the Ryan Gosling movie.
Oh my God, you're so right. I hadn't even picked up on that.
he's got a black coat with like a thing on the back. It's not the same thing. It's not the scorpion, but it's exactly the same coat.
It's close enough, yeah.
It is one of those coats. It's like I look how hard ass I am with my coat with like a skull stitched onto the back or whatever the hell.
Right.
He's got. So you have Todd walking in trying to play like he's the badass. You have Alfred Molina's character, who's dressed in a silver open robe and a Speedo, essentially.
Yeah, with nothing else on.
With just like a gold chain is like all he has left. And he's wandering around like nothing in these bikini briefs and a robe, and just hamming it up the entire scene. He's ranting in this robe with his Speedo out for the entire movie. And it is so disconcerting. His entire outfit is just so off-putting. And then you also have the bodyguard's outfit, and he's in this like really flowing outfit, and that's important because we get this one brief moment where we can see a gun underneath his clothing,
when he goes to pick up the baking soda, and I think it's Reed that notices the gun, and it's like, I believe the shot is even sort of a bit slow motion when he sees the gun.
It is. It's a slow motion scene of just like it looks like silk, his shirt opening up, and there being a gun holster inside, and that's it. It's interesting the way that you have costuming that kind of gets at the mania of a character with Alfred Molina's character, and you just have this functional outfit that, if he had been dressed differently, if the bodyguard had been dressed differently, we couldn't have seen the gun. So you can tell the style is somewhat there, so that we can get that lovely short slow motion shot of the fact that, oh shit, there's a gun in the scene. There's another gun now.
Right. Whereas with Dirk and Reed, the costuming doesn't particularly stand out, and that's kind of correct, because they have no interest in being here in the first place. Their function is to not be here.
They have come to like get in and out as quickly as possible.
They're all business.
the great thing, back to the sound that we didn't get to talk about with the music. So we've got the firecrackers going off, and we have the music, and what I love about the use of music in this scene is that it's not just there. It's very common in movies for people to try to use pop music as counterpoint for horrific scenes. That's not, especially in since Quentin Tarantino in Reservoir Dogs, we've gotten that a lot.
Yeah, ever since Mr. Blonde cut that ear off, like people have been trying to imitate it.
People are trying
often,
to ruin
often
pop
poorly.
Songs.
Yeah, exactly.
What I love about the music in this is it's totally motivated. This is not music that is just there for the viewer's point of view. It's there because Rahad is a pop music fiend, and he's created a series of, and I'm not making this up, awesome mixtapes.
and this is number six.
Yes, he has tapes that he has written awesome mixtape on and numbered, and he's filled with his own pop music. So all of this music we get in the scene is his soundtrack. He has given the soundtrack for this sequence all on his own, because he is obsessed with just terrible 80s pop songs.
And of course, the devil is playing awesome mixtape number 6 at this very moment.
I've been making awesome mixtape jokes for like, whatever, 15 years since this movie came out. It's like one awesome mixtape joke after another. And what I love about, since the music is motivated, and I've become really interested in things like lighting and sound that are motivated in the scene instead of part of the sort of either lighting that's there because the art wants it or music that's there because it's soundtrack. I'm always interested in scenes that create their light and sound as motivated artifacts in the scene. And I like it because you get moments like in the middle of the scene, Alfred Molina's character is ranting about he's giving the explanation of why he has these mixtapes, because he doesn't want to listen to songs in the order. Why do they have to put them in the order that I want to listen to them in my order? And what's great is he's starting to get scary because he's ranting.
He's getting more and more fevered as he goes on. And then all of a sudden, bam,
the music's gone.
Tape cuts out.
and it's
like this weird like Brechtian moment that suddenly reminds the audience that they're watching a movie.
Everything stops. He looks angry, and there's a moment where you're sort of not sure, is he going to lose it now?
Yeah.
Is this the moment when this guy who has been smoking an awful lot of crack during this scene, is he going to lose it? And then you get this like weird, and these are the things I love about Paul Thomas Anderson. In the middle of this tension building, in the middle of everyone freaking out because the music just stopped and he's ranting, suddenly you get this sequence of shots that perfectly establishes what's going on in the tape player. You get it pushes in onto the cassette player. It cuts to a super close up, and Anderson loves his super close ups.
Yes,
he does. This super close up of the tape stopping, and then it cuts to a super close up of the little lit up arrows of which direction the tape is going, and the arrow flips to show that the tape is reverse direction, and then it cuts back to the tape of it moving again, and then cuts back into the scene as the music starts again. And it's this moment which is just sort of like, and it focuses you on the mechanics of the tape the same way everyone else is, because they're also horrified.
Right.
By this music stopping. And I love that he just sort of cuts away to this probably 10 seconds worth of the tape flipping over.
And remember that this moment is just following on the heels of Rahad standing up in front of everyone and putting a gun under his head and like faking them out like he's going to shoot himself. And like everyone could not be more on edge, or so they think. And suddenly like music cuts out. And the audience just doesn't know what to do with themselves.
it's so horrible. And it's funny because when I've watched the scene like probably 10 times now, and even though I've taken very detailed notes on it, this is such a fevered scene that I have trouble remembering the chronology of which moments come when. Because you're right, I was thinking that the scene with the tape flipping over happened before he pulls out his gun, but it's not. It's after he pulls out his gun. And because the whole thing is such a nightmare. This entire scene is just a nightmare.
The way the tension in this sequence is orchestrated, they called Hitchcock the master of suspense, but this is as good as any Hitchcock sequence in terms of suspense.
It really is. It's one of the best tension builds I've ever seen.
It does what true suspense sequences are supposed to do, which is play the audience like a piano. Like, there are lulls, there are highs, and then it's a slow build and finally explodes.
And what's great, you know, Hitchcock always says, you know, like, if you cut to a bomb under the table, that's suspense. You know, a bomb going off isn't suspense. A bomb under the table is. And what's amazing about this scene is we know there's a bomb under the table, but those firecrackers keep going off. And so it always feels like the bomb is going off constantly, over and over again through this scene. You're expecting that release to happen, and then it doesn't, and the scene just keeps going.
That's very true.
And it's just over and over again. You're right. It completely plays you because, and it gets to the point where you're no longer sure what can go wrong, because you have Alfred Molina's character. He pulls out a gun, this like beautiful silvered handgun, puts a bullet into it, and plays Russian roulette with himself. For no good reason. just to show off that he will.
Establishing immediately how just thoroughly deranged this guy is.
And then you have the fact that there's his very terrifying bodyguard in the background. And he's measuring the fake cocaine they've given them. So you don't know if he's going to figure out what's going on.
Right. And this could go wrong at any moment if that bodyguard knows what he's doing at all.
and you know, one thing you had mentioned to me was the use of background action. I think this is a good time to talk about that because a lot of the tension happening is Cosmo in the background or the bodyguard in the background. There's a lot of things going on in the background of the scene.
I was thinking that this is just a tangent that occurred to me while you were talking about the firecrackers earlier. Doesn't Cosmo in this sequence kind of function the same way the Gimp does in the basement sequence in Pulp Fiction? Like, just this extremely bizarre character that acts as a counterpoint to even more horrific shit that's happening around him.
The thing that's so weird that it almost unmoors you from reality. Everything else, yes, you can maybe keep your head, but the fact that, like, you're like, just like the Gimp, the fact that there's someone setting off firecrackers with complete disregard to what's going on in the room.
Yeah. Like, he could not be more removed from this situation, and that's what kind of makes him terrifying.
You know what I realized? There's one moment in the scene where he sort of interacts with the scene that I didn't realize. And so one of the times when the music cuts off, I think, actually, it's when the tape goes off, and they're all, and the tape flips over, and they're all freaking out, and the firecracker goes off again, and Rahad gives his, like, oh, don't worry about him, he's Cosmo, he's Chinese, that's why he likes setting off firecrackers nonsense. And he walks over to Cosmo, and he, like, rubs his head and, like, smacks him on the butt, and then he walks away, and for a moment Cosmo turns around, lights a firecracker, and throws it at his head.
Yeah.
Like, he actually, it's the one time he interacts with anyone, he throws a firecracker at Rahad's head. Mm-hmm. After being smacked on the butt by him. Like, dude, go away. Like, I know, I, because you get the feeling that he treats this poor kid as, like, a toy.
Yeah, yeah, totally his boy toy. That was the sense that I got during that moment.
And I love that he just takes a moment to be like, I wish I could blow your head up. Like, yeah, that's just the impression you get in that one moment, that if Cosmo had his way in this scene, he would probably throw a larger firecracker at, yeah, Rahad's head. And I do love that. And the rest of the time, he's just back to throwing firecrackers.
Back to throwing firecrackers. I would love to see just like a one-shot comic book about the origin of Cosmo. because this guy, this has to be like Stockholm Syndrome at this point, is the impression I get from the way that he interacts with Rahad in the scene.
I do think it's interesting because there's very subtle indications, you know, besides that Rahad, you know, that he might be gay, because,
yeah,
because the other thing is that if you notice that when Todd says he knows him from Party Boys, which I believe is the strip club that he works at.
Yes, you're right.
So that seems to be his in. And I do like that that's not really a big deal in this scene. You know, it's not really a call out. It's there as the subtext to his character.
It's there, but it's not made a big deal out of.
Yeah, it's yeah. There's so much mania going on with, yeah, his character, that who he is beyond his kind of drugged up mania is really hard to get, mm-hmm, to get at. I mean, this is the kind of person that beyond putting a gun to his head and playing Russian roulette stops the scene twice to sing along with the songs.
Right. And I love that so much. I love how much both the character and obviously Paul Thomas Anderson revels in just how awesome these songs are. Like, all of that passion is put on Front Street in this sequence.
It's a great use of 80s pop music that I otherwise mostly dislike, with the exception, right, of 99 Luftballons, which I do like.
Right.
But so anyways, I'm sorry, we got off track. I wanted to talk about the background action, because,
yes,
there's,
yes,
a lot going on and in the background, you know, there's always, this is a very deeply shot scene. One thing I noticed lighting wise is that the use of lighting helps emphasize the background stuff, because there's, it's almost all motivated lighting in the scene. There's chandeliers, there's lamps, there's these weird like blue window things, but the way he uses it is that there's lighting at all these different levels in the scene, so that you have back in the room where the bodyguard is doing the drug stuff, there's like a chandelier over him, and then back in a bedroom, there's a light on in the bedroom behind there, and it makes the space feel huge. This house feels humongous, just this one room.
And like you were saying, a lot of the lighting is practical within the scene, and so much of it is in the background that it does leave the backgrounds illuminated, but it often leaves the people in the foreground in a shade of darkness.
You're
which,
right,
I think is really important.
Yeah, you're right. The lighting is all the walls. A lot of the times the characters are sitting in subpar lighting.
Yeah,
during the actual scenes.
In shadow, really.
Yeah, yeah. That is a really excellent point that I hadn't realized. Whereas, mm-hmm, the walls and other rooms are extremely well lit. There are some very hot, mm-hmm, lighting bits in this, you know, like there are lamps along the wall, there are the chandeliers that give this very bright, these bright pops all over the scene.
Right.
But
and obviously this house that they're in, it's very ornate, it's very impressive. The well lit background could kind of be taken as what they, or at least Todd, was expecting when they went in, and then them in the center in darkness is what they actually got.
You're absolutely correct. It gives this sense of, like, you know, it feels very rich all around them. It's very wealthy and ornate all around them, and there they are on this couch in very muted, low contrast lighting. Yeah,
the lighting as much as what's actually happening in the scene is a perversion of how this was originally supposed to go.
Totally. And the other thing you get out of all that depth with the lighting is that one thing. So this cinematography is by Robert Elswit, who's a cinematographer that I like a great deal. I think he's excellent. He does Magnolia and a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson's movies, in fact. And one thing I really like about him is that he goes hard for multicolored lighting in scenes. There's a lot of different colors going on. A lot of times cinematographers tend towards, especially now with digital photography, you end up with a lot of very monochrome lighting setups.
Very monochrome, nothing that particularly stands out, a little bland even.
Yeah, whereas this is, there are blues,
there's blues,
oranges.
There's red.
Yeah. It is a very, but it never goes to garish, but it's funny. I mentioned as a sort of a joke the driver thing, but it's something that Nicholas Wendig, Reffin?
I don't know. That sounds wrong, but I've heard other people say it that way.
It's the same kind of lighting that he uses in the Driver and in Only God Forgives. It's the same kind of thing where you have this very diverse palette of lighting colors.
That's true.
Going on. And I like that because, again, it kind of contrasts the scene in this case where you have this, like, kind of exciting, happy, like, ostentatious lighting design, while these characters, again, in the middle are, like, these strung-out, poorly-lit human beings.
Right. So in a sense, the lighting kind of functions the same exact way the music does.
Yeah, it totally does. It calls out certain areas while forcing the important areas to feel very, under... You can just tell that there's dread happening, that this little circle that they're in is just waiting for something to go wrong.
And just highlighting that tension even more.
Totally.
It's so great.
And as you said, you know, you have a great deal of motion going on in the background, even though there's people in the background. Cosmo is always moving in the background, and you can't always see him there, but
you're not sure where he's at.
But he'll just kind of wander into the scene and throw a firecracker and then wander back out. And occasionally you'll see the bodyguard look up, and you don't know why.
Right.
He's looking up.
That's one thing I love about the sequence is that at the beginning when they're entering, you get several like very wide shots and it establishes the geography of this room really, really well, so that as the scene progresses when he starts using these tighter camera angles and, like you said, Cosmo coming in and out of the bathroom, or not bathroom, background. I don't know, maybe he went to the bathroom, and like the bodyguard doing his thing with the baking soda, it puts you even more on edge because you know how this room is laid out.
Yeah, it does. That is one of the key aspects of any kind of tension or action filmmaking that we lose a lot is the proper establishment of geography.
Yes.
And this is a big room, and it's actually a fairly wide open room, and it would be easy to take that for granted and not establish what's going on. But because he does, you know there are these doors everywhere. You know that there's this little spot where the bodyguard is. You know that there's a little alcove with a bar, which they use when the gunfire starts, they hop into. So when the gunfire actually starts, you actually have a good sense of where everyone is in the room, even though it's kind of a big open room.
That's true.
Let's talk a little bit about Paul Thomas Anderson's shot selection, because having done a couple of these podcasts so far, I'm used to directors who feel like they've storyboarded out their scene very carefully, that they have very careful shot selection. But Paul Thomas Anderson really feels like he shoots things from as many different angles and distances, and sometimes moving cameras and sometimes stable cameras, and that I get the feeling that a lot of this is done in the editing room, the scene construction.
Like he shoots it a million different ways and then picks the best moments once he gets to the cutting room.
Is that the impression that you get as well?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I don't... And honestly, for a scene as complex and complicated as this one, and for some of the other sequences in the movie, like, I think that's probably, like, the best way to do it, because there's so much going on that it would be, with a standard approach to shot design, it would almost be impossible to capture every little nuance in the way that it needs to be captured.
And as a director, Paul Thomas Anderson generally tends to disregard and reject the master shot, close-up, over-shoulder, cut-back-and-forth kind of thing that you get in standard right. Hollywood filmmaking. You don't see a lot of that from him.
That's true. He's definitely a director who's not opposed to a shot calling attention to itself if it needs to.
Yeah, he likes the shots to be characters in the filmmaking as well, you know. Some directors go out of their way to make sure you don't notice the editing, you don't notice the shot selection, whereas Anderson, there's a lot of push-ins and pull-outs in the scene. There's a lot of camera moves, pans or sometimes when characters are ranting, the camera will just pan back and forth as they move across the room.
Right.
When I do this, I try to look for a rhythm to the shot selection and editing in a scene, and I found that I was kind of failing at this in this one. And there's only one that I would say really consistent shot selection structure that he uses in the scene. And what it is, it's most of the scene when Alfred Molina is ranting in the middle of the room, we get a series of shots that all kind of do the same thing, which is either shots that are straight on him with him more or less in the center of the frame that kind of treat it as him performing, like him on stage. And then you get shots that are reaction shots of the three guys on the couch looking like, what the hell is going on? How are we trapped in the room with this
Snuggwog? Right. And generally just that medium three shot of the boys, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You get that medium three shot of the boys, and you get, and there seems to be two shots that he uses a lot to get across that audience feel. One is just him in the frame, kind of the medium shot of just him in the frame. And occasionally he cuts back further where you get the sort of, the silhouettes of the three boys on the couch with the back of their heads. And him ranting in front of them. But all that sort of gives the sense of Ray Hodd having basically performing for them.
That's so true. And that's a great point. I'm so glad you pointed that out, because like that actor audience dynamic that you were talking about, that takes place like right before the music cuts out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it further removes you from what's happening.
Yeah, it does. It makes you feel like you are, you know, you're an enforced audience member to Ray Hodd's manic scale up of ranting. Like, he's just so happy to have people in the room to rant at, and you don't want to be in the room.
He doesn't have a podcast.
Yes, unfortunately, he's stuck just bringing in druggies to his house. But other than that, there isn't a lot. I mean, you get a lot of, you know, but the other side of that is that doesn't mean that Paul Thomas Anderson is not thoughtful about his shot selection. He definitely feels like he shoots from as much as he can, but it also doesn't feel like he has a very keen understanding of what a camera should be doing. Like, there's the scene when near the end of the scene, they've made the deal. Everything looks good. They can just leave. Mm-hmm. They go to get up and leave. And Todd on the couch does not get up and sort of starts muttering to himself that what he doesn't want to go. It's not time to go yet. There's something else I want from you. And he's muttering to himself. And Anderson does this very long, slow push-in on Todd. Right. It's a very slow shot as we stick with him. And we get maybe one cut away from that and then back to the push-in. And that is a very intentional shot. That reminds me of The Godfather, and there's a scene in The Godfather where Michael Corleone finally sort of comes into his own and he describes the plan that he's going to use to take out Sollozzo in the restaurant, and it's the same thing, just a character sitting on a chair and a slow push-in, and that is a really powerful thing to use when a character is building themselves up to a moment, because the closer we get, the closer they get to their epiphany or their moment, and you know, so Anderson knew what he was doing in there. He wasn't just randomly throwing shots at the wall. That is a deliberate shot.
That's totally true. And like you were saying, the shot slowly pushes in on Todd as he's ranting. And anytime we do cut away, it's generally to Rahad, who at this point has no choice but to just listen until he finishes and then blow him away. But the shot on Rahad is also very, very subtly pushing in on him. So it's kind of mimicking the action of that shot so that the audience won't be taken out of the rhythm.
I like that. That's excellent. Yeah. That is excellent. Anderson loves moving cameras, either whether it be a zoom or a push-in or a tracking shot. He loves steady cam shots, and we get a good selection of various types of shots that he likes in this. There are, you know, we pan across the room at various times. Sometimes he tracks along with characters. He loves dynamic camera work.
Yes. But at one very key moment in this scene, all he does is let the camera sit on Mark Wahlberg's face.
I am so glad you brought this up, because I wanted to talk about this shot. Because
it's another epiphany moment.
So I'm curious. So we, you know, the Jesse's girl's playing, and and Rahat is singing along with it, and we cut to Mark Wahlberg, and all sound but the music drops out. We can see Reed's mouth moving but can't hear what he's saying, and we're just on this vacant expression on Dirk Diggler, and I am really curious what is he thinking? What is going through Dirk's head in this shot?
Okay, well, when it first cuts to Dirk and all we're hearing is the music, what's the first lyric of the song that we hear? Do you know?
No, what is it?
I play along with the charade.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like that.
So that's immediately a comment on what's happening in the scene. But Dirk at I think this is him realizing what we were talking about, that yes, things are as bad as they seem.
it is a horrifying look on his face, because it doesn't look like him thinking. It doesn't look like he's happy or sad. He almost looks he's a little mad, like a little insane at this moment. Like,
yeah. And it's a slow build up to that anger too. Like, prior to this shot in the scene, like he's obviously very like nervous and still probably a bit drugged out going into this deal, and he's not very forthcoming with any emotion. But when we get to this shot, at first it's just like blank face, and then it slowly builds up to anger, like you said. And then as soon as the shot breaks, he stands up, and suddenly he's the one calling the shots. Like, hey, guys, it's time to go.
This great moment where he, like, actually, like, looks down and grimaces and puts his hand to his temple. Like, and you can just tell, like, it's like a breaking moment. Like, he's staring, and he feels trapped, and he's almost, like, losing it.
Yeah.
And then he just has that moment where he's like, what the fuck is going on, you know? Like, you can just see, like, he finally kind of realizes...
I think on some level, this is Dirk realizing, hey, I'm better than this. Let's get the fuck out of here.
And I love scenes like this where directors feel like they can hang with a character as they think. I remember reading a review by Roger Ebert of Jackie Brown, back when Jackie Brown came out, which is one of my favorite movies, by the way.
Same here. Absolutely.
Fantastic movie. And there's a scene near the end after all the deals have gone bad, and... it's Samuel Jackson and Robert De Niro in the car, and Robert De Niro makes a comment, and Ordell Roby, who's Samuel Jackson's character, is like, hold on, let me think. And you see
the vein pop out.
Yes. And the camera just hangs with him while he thinks. Any other movie would have had to make a decision immediately, but we actually hang with him while he thinks, and it's both tension building, and it also just seats you in that feeling of pieces clicking together, and it's so hard to do that as a director, and I'm sure you know this, having put stuff together, you get afraid when you're hanging with a shot that long. You start to get nervous that you're boring everyone.
But it is absolutely one of the best ways to put the viewer in the headspace of the character that's being focused on. I can't remember who mutual friend Ken was telling me about this. I can't remember where he heard this quote from, but someone was saying that one of the most powerful things that you can see happen on screen in a movie or a TV show is watching the moment when a character makes a decision.
And most movies are afraid to do that. It is hard to do that. It's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to get a character to do that. And it's so many subtle things happening. It's performance.
Because most movies are so much, their plot is so much on wheels.
Yeah.
That it won't stop to play out the moment that makes it make sense on a character level.
Exactly. And it's those moments that make a scene work. And it's funny because it's those moments that make a scene rewatchable. One of the things I got out of the scene that I was not expecting, Joan, I'm really glad you chose this, because this is a favorite scene from a favorite movie, and I still managed to pull things out. And for the first time watching this, I realized that Todd did not think this deal was going to go down well. He came into this expecting Rehad to reject what they were doing. And so there's this moment when he, and this is another great moment of hanging with a character. So Rahad goes, all right, what's the price? And there's this long scene of Todd laughing. He can't answer the question. He's laughing, and the camera only cuts away once or twice to show Rahad. We don't know what he's thinking at all.
Right.
And Todd is laughing. And then he finally goes, $5,000. And when Alfred Molina, when Rahad says, sure, and then his bodyguard just walks up and hands him the money. There is a moment on Thomas Jane's face, where it is clear he's like, shit. I was expecting to turn this down so that I could pull the gun and rob him. That was going to be my opening. I now believe pretty firmly that Todd's intention was for the deal to go south so that he would have an excuse to pull that gun and rob the safe.
That's so true, man. I hadn't even noticed that myself. That's a great call. And even when the bodyguard hands him the money, he even looks at the bodyguard and he kind of just incredulously goes, $5,000? Like, really?
Like, he was never expecting that he was actually going to go down this easily. He was totally conning his friends to get him in this house to rob this guy.
He was not supposed to get this far in the level bringing the weapons out.
And I think that's why he ends up having to build himself up to the moment of demanding it, because he was expecting an opening and he didn't get his opening. And there's a scene where if we hadn't gotten those long moments of him freaking out and laughing and answering the question and the shots of him reacting, all of those things build up to this subtext to the scene that you don't need to understand the emotions of the scene. But the more you watch, the more you can go, that's what that character was doing. Right. That was his motivation in that. And it doesn't reject what you already knew. It enhances the scene. And I do love... I love the long shots in this scene. For a director who is as dynamic and shot-lovey as Anderson, man knows when to hold a shot.
And he does, absolutely. And in the scene, it's so important because, as you know, the longer you hold a shot without cutting, the more tense it is.
Because you're waiting. What's going to happen when this cut happens? And what's great is sometimes he's great because sometimes nothing happens when that
sometimes
cut happens.
It's completely mundane.
Totally. But other times
it's shocking, which we learn at the end of the sequence.
One thing before we get to like the catharsis of the sequence I want to talk about is performance-wise, obviously Alfred Molina is out of his head amazing in this scene.
He's so incredible. Like, prior to seeing this movie, I think the only thing I had seen him in was Spider-Man 2. And just seeing him playing this character coked out of his head, just not even remotely on the same planet as anyone in this movie or the world at large, was mind-boggling.
And he's playing almost the exact same note that you describe with the music, where on the surface, he is entirely happy. He wants friends, he wants to talk about his music, on the surface, this is the most genial man in the world, but there's this undercurrent of mania. Like, he is not happy, he's manic. He's gonna lose his shit at any moment, and because of the way he plays it, it's...
over the tiniest thing, too.
Exactly. Like, he's terrifying because he seems so happy on the surface, and you know it's not true. And the music plays into this falsity of happiness that he is pretty much maintaining all on his own.
Right.
But the performance that surprised me in this, going back to it, because Molina is obviously phenomenal. This is Molina's scene. You know, this is just a one of those I'm gonna own the movie kind of scenes.
Yeah.
but who's amazing is Thomas Jane.
Yes.
I saw him in other movies after this, like Deep Blue Sea, and I really thought he wasn't a very good actor. And then I realized this was him. He is really, really good in this scene.
Yes, I'm struggling to describe his performance because on some level it's almost just as manic as Alfred Molina's. Like, not at first, but it reaches that height.
Yeah, he's like, you know, he laughs randomly, like that scene where he's laughing, he's building up to demanding the safe money.
Yeah,
and then so after he demands so Todd demands money in the floor safe, and he gets this great rambling monologue about how he wants the money in the floor safe, and then everything goes to shit. Everything immediately goes straight to hell.
Stands up, pulls the gun out, and it's all downhill from there, literally.
Yeah, and what I love, as soon as the scene it starts, this, no one is actually afraid of Todd. He yells at the bodyguard to stop and not to reach into his jacket, and the bodyguard's
hand goes ahead and reaches into his jacket.
He's still reaching in, and then and then Brehad runs for his gun and just starts clicking until the Russian roulette comes up, bang,
and shoots him in the shoulder.
And so no one is afraid of Todd in this scene. Everyone realizes Todd is kind of an idiot,
right?
But through chance and fortuitousness, he doesn't die when the first shot hits him, so he gets to gun down the poor bodyguard. I feel bad for the bodyguard in this scene, man. What a horrible job to work for Brehad.
He was an innocent bystander in all this, really.
He's got the worst boss possible. He's just trying to keep this moron psychopath safe.
Right.
And then some other moron psychopath guns him down in the middle of the scene. But then, so and, that, go but, ahead, and, sorry.
No, But then after Todd gets shot and he gets back up and he keeps shooting, he still keeps talking.
And that's where we get this third amazing moment of Thomas Jane's performance where he's like trying to convince his friends to go into the bedroom to get this money. And he starts crying.
It's so incredible.
It is. I mean, it is like this amazing moment where it is clear that he is just not. He has lost contact with what is a smart and real thing to do in this moment. He's weeping almost about, like, we have to go into the bedroom and get the money. I mean, this is a brave performance from Thomas Jane.
It is.
Especially for a guy who comes off as such a macho jerk earlier on in the movie. He loses it in this scene in kind of a sad way. It's not the kind of, like, we're used to these kinds of, like, crazy friend loses his mind scenes in movies. But the fact that it's clear somewhere in his head, he knows he's already gone over the line too. He knows this is his rock bottom as well.
And prior to this scene, Todd was a character we liked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was friendly.
He was friendly, and that's another thing about that long shot on Dirk when he has his realization. On some level, he's realizing that if I don't do something, I could one day be Todd.
Yeah, this is a great, like, you know, like, ludicrous take on the addiction rock bottom scene, because you kind of get both people's rock bottom, and Todd's rock bottom is depressingly terrible. Just like a series of terrible decisions.
You get both rock bottoms, but it never feels preachy like it would in another movie.
Totally. Because you don't feel like they learn a lesson other than my life sucks. That's pretty much the only lesson
that's the extent
learns.
Of it.
So Todd freaks out. He goes into the bedroom, and you get actually one of my favorite shot selections in this sequence, which is you get a shot which is almost point of view from in the bedroom. The door opens up.
Yes.
Todd walks in, and then his chest explodes. That shotgun goes off and just kills him immediately.
And then it cuts back to Alfred Molina, and he's holding this gun. He takes a beat, and then he just starts,
He loses it, runs out into the door, starts calling them puppies, which is just one of the most ridiculous possible statements. I mean, it's like the fact that he starts shouting puppies in this scene is great. But yeah, he loses it. He runs out, and it's just a terrible shot, thankfully, because our characters get out. But he just him and this shotgun is suddenly, now we finally have bangs that are terrifying. You know, now we have this series of gunshots that are everything that the firecrackers presaged to us.
And when they're running out, I love this shot. As soon as they exit the door, at first it kind of seems like it's a point of view from Alfred Molina's character, but like the closer it gets to them, the more you realize it's not. But it's just this, like, it looks like it's handheld, just racing at them, trying to get into the car, and Alfred Molina shoots the car's window out, and Dirk falls back on his ass, and it's just like, it is the worst thing that could possibly happen.
That is a great shot. It's awesome, because it's probably a Steadicam shot, because it's just a little too smooth, but because it's going downstairs, it has that handheld kind of feel to it.
Yeah, you're right.
It's great. And actually, this is another time when the sound design is really important, because, so, when the guy, as soon as Todd stands up to start doing his nonsense, the song changes from Jesse's Girl to 99 Lift Balloons.
Right.
And we get 99 Lift Balloons over most of this ludicrous, horrible action scene when half the characters die. Mm-hmm. As soon as we run out of the house, the song is gone. We get soundtrack now, actually. There's like a little bit of drum music that's basically the actual film's soundtrack.
Yeah, the score.
But we don't, the music, the pop music only exists within Rahad's house.
Right.
As soon as they're outside, it's actually abrupt. It's a little jarring.
It is, yeah.
One thing I realized, I don't know if you, so 99 Lift Balloons plays over the scene. Mm-hmm. I actually had to go look up when the movie was made, because Gross Point Blank uses 99 Lift Balloons in almost the exact same capacity.
Does it? I've seen that movie, but not for a long time.
There's a sequence near the end of the movie in Gross Point Blank when an assassin attacks him, and he kills the assassin. And as soon as I can't think of who the actress is, and I love her, and I'm blanking on her name. I'm an idiot. Yeah. So
Minnie Driver
runs and sees the dead body, and as soon as she sees the dead body, 99 Lift Balloons starts, and it plays over a sequence of them trying to get rid of the body. So it's another kind of manic post action sequence with this playing. And I was curious which did it first. Was one of them ripping off the other in terms of the use of it? And no, they both came out in 1997.
That's right.
So these two movies both kind of used 99 Lift Balloons as this counterpoint to horrific violence in their own ways. They both kind of came at it in this sort of sardonic use of this song to go against action.
It's so funny when that happens with movies and even with TV, how the two movies within a given year will have a similar moment or use a song in a similar way that kind of gives you an idea of what the social consciousness is within filmmaking circles is at the moment.
Yeah, it's that kind of collective unconscious thing, you know,
Like I remember in 2012, there were two movies and one TV show that all used the song "I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight" by Richard and Linda Thompson.
And you know, you expect like maybe if it's in the studio system, maybe you know that kind of traveled through the studio. But these are two relatively indie movies. You know, sometimes that's why you get these things where it's like these are not movies that had any communication with each other. These are both, you know, kind of auteurist statements on.
And at this point, this is an older song, too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've kind of hit... That is the one thing. And we did hit that moment of, like, 80s revival. Because, you know, this is the year of both Gross Point Blank and Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion, which are both 80s throwback movies. And then this is sort of a 70s into 80s throwback movie. So we were certainly hitting that point where 80s were the nostalgia, which accounts for part of it. But it is interesting when those things use it. But I do like it. It's a great song for that because it's a great pop song as pop songs go. 99 Luftballons is just a phenomenal song, and having it play over a sequence of people getting gunned down and in some ways it doesn't even counterpoint it so much as just kind of feed into the energy of the scene because it's such like a weird upbeat song and everyone else is so manic in this scene.
And the song itself starts out kind of mellow too and builds to that upbeat.
Yes. Yeah, it basically hits it right when he goes to the door, I think.
And right before he gets shot.
Yeah. We get the sort of singing bit and then he goes in and as soon as the actual beat starts is basically when Alfred Molina runs out with the shotgun and starts getting everyone down.
Right. That's awesome.
Anderson is a great use of music, and this is a great use of music movie overall. But that's a really awesome use of music to like trigger you into the next phase of the scene.
Absolutely. So the final phase of the scene.
Yes, we get into the outside bit, I guess, here. The chase down the road.
Yeah.
In the car.
Dirk and Reed are heading for the car. Rahad's chasing them from behind, still with the shotgun.
Blowing windows out of...
Blows the window out. Dirk falls on his ass. The car starts moving, and there's this great shot from the passenger seat of the car of just, like, the door closing as it starts to move. And you can see Rahad a little bit in the background still coming at them with the gun.
I love this bit because, you know, Rahad is fairly ineffective with the shotgun because the shotgun is just not meant for this kind of thing, and the car takes most of the damage, but it's interesting because this is not a movie with action in it, but you know this is like about like 15 seconds of chase movie, you know, going on with this, and I love that it picks up. He runs out of the house, he guns at the car, and the car gets away, and Rahad just sort of walks back into the house.
Yeah, like oh well, that just happened.
The scene just sort of like trails off. I love it. You expect there to be some like real bit, but as soon as he's away because the guy's a crackhead with a shotgun and he's not
trying to leave his house tonight.
and I like that because of the nature of the scene, Reed runs off, so we actually
were
forced to stay with Dirk through the end of the scene as he realizes exactly how screwed up his life has become.
After he does finally get into the car, there's a great shot from behind the steering wheel, like with Dirk looking into his rearview mirror, and the back window of the car just explodes. The Coens did that same exact shot in No Country for Old Men 10 years later.
Did they? It's the same shot, basically.
Same shot, yeah.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, that's great. It's a great shot of the window exploding. Yeah.
And then something you pointed out, the car does take most of the damage in this scene. At the end of the sequence, obviously, Dirk realizes that his car is out of gas. I wonder if it was like that beforehand or if it just leaked out after the gas tank got shot.
And it's hard to tell because he's such a mess at this point. He easily could have gone to an idiotic drug deal with an empty tank of gas. You know, he is exactly the type of person to have done that.
That's true.
But the car also could have leaked. I do love that. It's maybe an on-the-nose metaphor, but it's a great metaphor that his car is now out of gas.
right.
at this moment, that even his car doesn't want to go on.
And then something else I noticed, Dirk is driving away. He's like beating the steering wheel. Just he starts to cry. He's so panicked. He realizes the car is on empty, and it's still nighttime out at this point. But then it cuts to a scene that looks as though it's the next morning, with the Dirk just slowly rolling the car up.
Yeah, this has been all night of him trying to get this car going.
Yeah. His dark night of the soul literally is over.
There's this one brief set of shot selection that I want to mention before we get done with the scene, because it's a classic Paul Thomas Anderson technique. When he gets in the car, and the car stalled, so he has to turn the key, and we get this series of very close shots, which is, again, one of those Paul Thomas Anderson things. We get the key turning, we get the stick shift moving, we get his foot on the gas, and it's like this collection of shots that gets across an action. And directors handle communicating a complicated action in different ways, and one of the ways Paul Thomas Anderson has always done it is very fast cuts showing close-ups
right.
of the action at hand. And he does this a lot before the scene, like the entry point to the scene in the first place was them
packing up the fake Coke and grabbing the keys.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And you get that here where it's like key turning, car, you know, foot on clutch, shift, gear shifting, foot on gas. You know, and you get it's very carefully selected shots that mm-hmm. give you the sequence of actions that the person is doing, but never so long that it gets boring. I think it's just a really brilliant way of communicating a complicated action in a way that you understand what's going on without the momentum of the scene dying.
Yeah, without having to over-explain it. That's another thing with that shot selection leading up to this sequence. I watched that little scene but prior to this scene, and I was just like, I bet Edgar Wright loves this movie.
I didn't think about that. Edgar Wright uses those same kinds of shots. He does it
the same quick cuts with a similar rhythm.
Yeah, I never thought about that, but you're absolutely correct. That is that's sort of a signature Edgar Wright thing. Edgar Wright tends to pair them with very specific sound effects.
Yeah. It's
just sort of his twist on that idea. But mm-hmm. I really do love that I love Paul Thomas Anderson's close-ups. And, you know, one thing I learned as a filmmaker myself watching the commentary for this movie, and it wasn't in this scene, but was there's a scene of a record needle going on a record. And he had mentioned that when you do ultra close-ups, you can choose one thing to be in focus and nothing else will be. You know, right. You can choose the needle and everything else will be out of focus. Or you can choose the record groove, and the record groove will be in focus and nothing else. And that was one of those things I immediately stuck in my head and kept on to, that when you get that close, you can only focus on one detail. And I think that's a really good thing to remember
right.
in these scenes. And that's why they're good, because only one thing can be in focus. It immediately locks your eye on the thing that you're supposed to look at.
And that's the point of the extreme close-up anyway, to focus your eye on that thing. And the focus work just adds to that.
Yeah, right, because you still have a giant frame, and what's great is that way you can close up on something that's focused. So you can focus on the idea of a foot on the pedal, but you get the toe is what's most in focus. So you get the action of that toe more than anything else. Even if you're not thinking about it, your mind focuses on the one in focus point in the shot. So it actually leads you – it's amazing that it keys you in exactly where you want to be keyed into.
Yeah.
Just a great scene, man. I am so glad you chose the scene, even though this is actually – I thought – Greg chose Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and I thought that scene was going to kill me.
Yeah.
This was actually an incredibly difficult scene for me to come up with a technique to discuss. I've been better at coming up with a focus, and this we really kind of
like you said,
there's just
so much in it.
Yeah.
I started to take notes when I was rewatching the scene earlier today, but I very quickly just gave up because there's too much. I think we've hit a lot of the important things though.
We have. It's a complicated scene, and it really shows that Paul Thomas Anderson's technique is it feels very intuitive, as opposed to a lot of directors who feel very intellectual about their technique. I get the feeling that, especially from this movie, that Anderson really feels his scenes in a way.
He feels his scenes and perhaps shoots them or lets them play out in a way that's more organic than perhaps a director who's more controlled, like, say, Stanley Kubrick possibly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Where you really feel it. I want to point out really that the editing is by Dylan. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Chichinor,
maybe.
Great. The editing is fantastic. We mentioned the fact that we get the feeling that Anderson's scenes are constructed somewhat in editing. So you have to mention the editor because that is an unsung hero of film. And Anderson movie is edited really well. So
editors can make or break a scene.
Yeah, especially when you're a filmmaker like Hitchcock, who basically storyboards your scenes before you shoot them, and thus you're only shooting what you need. Okay, the editor in that case is unfortunately probably the slave to his storyboards. But in the majority of filmmaking scenes, it's the editor who finds the rhythm that the director intends.
Right.
And Dylan is it works with a lot of stuff.
It's a huge responsibility because, like, yes, you're responsible for the greatness of some of these scenes, but it's also on you if a scene isn't working.
Yeah. And not a lot of directors can communicate exactly what they want. You know, they're communicating a feel and they can tell when it's right or wrong, but it's on you.
Because a scene could be completely and totally there on the page and on the set the day they shot, but if it's not edited with absolute precision, something could be off, and an audience is going to know that.
Exactly. And Paul Thomas Anderson movies are masterstrokes of editing. You know, all of his movies. I mean, Magnolia might be the top of it, but they're all masterstrokes.
Agreed.
So, well, Joe, thank you so much for being here with me to discuss one of my favorite scenes and one of my favorite movies. It just a real pleasure to discuss this scene with you.
Thank you for having me, dude. It's been rewarding. Like, I've loved this scene for so long. It's been rewarding to finally just sit down and talk with someone about why it's as great as it is.
Same feeling. Before we let you go, can you you want to tell the audience where they can find you online?
You can follow me on Twitter at Toasted Schizo. Again, that's S-C-H-I-Z-O. And you can watch my short films and other such whimsies at youtube.com/ToastedSchizo.
Thank you, Joe. I am Eric Sippel. I'm the host of Making the Scene. You can find me on Twitter at Salon. That's S-A-A-L-O-N. And this podcast, as well as my rambling writings, can be found on my blog at SalonMuyo, SalonMuyo.com. Thank you for listening, everyone. We'll be back next time with another great scene.